From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Remember the boy in the film Empire of the Sun? The character was first created by J.G. Ballard in his semi-autobiographical novel about growing up in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. As an adult, Ballard became an internationally acclaimed science fiction writer. Coming up, we meet J.G. Ballard. Also today, we introduce you to a singer who's establishing herself as an interpreter of American popular song. Her name is Wesla Whitfield. And we'll have reviews of the new jazz album from Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy and of the new TV remake of The Caine Mutiny. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. If you saw the movie Empire of the Sun, then you have some idea what J.G. Ballard's boyhood was like. Steven Spielberg adapted the movie from Ballard's semi-autobiographical novel about coming of age in a prisoner of war camp during World War II. The camp was just outside Shanghai, where Ballard's father managed a British firm. Until Empire of the Sun, Ballard was best known for his science fiction stories and novels. He never belonged to the Aliens from Space school of science fiction. He has said that science fiction is really about the here and now, and that we are living inside an enormous science fiction novel. Ballard's new novel isn't science fiction. It's called The Day of Creation, and it's set in contemporary Central Africa. I spoke to J.G. Ballard from the NPR Bureau in New York and asked him if he still thinks of himself as a science fiction writer.
Well, strictly speaking, I haven't written any science fiction for quite a long time. Unfortunately, these labels, you know, stick like super glue. And the last science fiction I wrote was back in the 60s, strictly speaking, 20 years ago. But, you know, I don't mind because I've always been proud to be a science fiction writer. I think science fiction is probably, you know, the true literature of the 20th century. And you know, I've never shied away from it, but I, you know, the fact is that there are a lot of people who don't like SF, and the recent novels I've written, like Empire of the Sun, and now this new book, The Day of Creation, are not science fiction in any way, whatever.
In what respect do you think science fiction is the true literature of the 20th century?
Well, it describes change. It's a literature about change and about scientific and technological change. I mean, we're living in a science fiction landscape. I mean, in many ways, I think we're living inside a science fiction novel. The world we inhabit is the creation of the scientific imagination. And the kind of, you know, the so-called mainstream novel, which is just about, you know, Charles and Diana living in, you know, Pasadena or Tunbridge Wells in England and who've got their social problems, isn't really about the world we live in. We live in a world of computers and jet travel, of nuclear weapons. Science fiction at least tries to respond to that world.
But your science fiction, I think, was never the kind of techno science fiction.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I described my SF as the science fiction of inner space, psychological space is what interested me. There are no alien planets in my fiction. There are no spaceships. There are no sort of galaxies millions of years ahead. It's all set on this planet today, the here and now. I'm interested in the sort of landscape that we actually inhabit. The landscape of high-rises and motorways, the modern world of jet travel and computers and above all, the media landscape of, mass magazines, mass newspapers, radio and TV, which this is the air that people breathe.
My guest is writer J.G. Ballard, and his new novel is titled The Day of Creation. Now, you're autobiographical novel, Empire of the Sun, was recently made into a movie by Steven Spielberg with a screenplay by Tom Stoppard. You had very extraordinary experiences as a child. You were living in Shanghai and with your parents in a British community and became a prisoner of war in a Japanese camp during World War II. I was surprised to find out that unlike your book and the movie based on your book, You were imprisoned with your parents. In your book, you're separated and you're imprisoned alone.
Yes. I mean, I've never made any secret of that. I mean, Empire of the Sun is a novel.
Right.
It's semi-autobiographical. It's partly based on my own first-hand experiences. And part of it, being a novel, is invented. But there are many points of contact. I mean, I'm the same age as the boy, Jim. I was born in Shanghai like him. I lived in that house, went to that school, had those parents. I was in Shanghai when the Japanese invaded China. I was there in Shanghai when, the morning after Pearl Harbor, they seized Shanghai. And I was interned in the same camp. But, and it's a big difference, my parents were with me. Though, I'd say that, I mean, people have said to me, we know it's a novel, but why, you know, why did you leave your parents out? And I think the reason is that it was psychologically truer to my own experiences to present my alter ego, as it were, the boy Jim in the book, to present him alone, because I think I was alone. I think a sort of estrangement took place between myself and my parents during the camp years, and the book is truer to the psychology of my own life.
Well, you know, you get the impression of a child who was, you know, fairly repressed, you know, and coming up in a prosperous family, suddenly having to survive on his wits in this camp and becoming very, very resourceful, learning how to steal and trade to get extra food, to get books, to get other items that would be of interest or of value. Did you go through that yourself?
Yes, I did. I mean, a lot of the boy's experiences in Empire of the Sun are taken straight from my own life. I used to run errands for the American merchant seamen who were in the camp and who had a hoard of Reader's Digests, which were, you know, I'd do anything to get hold of those.
What's an example of one of the things you did to get hold of them?
Well, I you know, run general errands for them. I mean, things like crawling through the wire and setting up these pheasant traps that I describe in the book, or, you know, sort of collecting bits of wood for the little fires that people would light, and general dogs bodying around the place. I wasn't constantly scavenging. I don't want to give that impression, but you've got to, I mean, this was a big camp, 2,000 people, the size of a small town, and it was really a huge slum. And as in all slums, it's the teenage boys who run wild. And, you know, I ran wild.
It must be really something to come of age, to undergo puberty while living in a prisoner of war camp.
Yes, I mean, I wouldn't say that anything wonderful and mysterious happened to me. One ran around with a pack of pretty wild girls at the same time. Yes, it was. I mean, it was a huge nuclear family. I mean, this was the bizarre thing. There were about 300 children, and we all ran wild together. I mean, it's a strange thing to say, but in many ways, I had quite a good time there.
Well, it's certainly the impression you get from the book and the movie, that there were a lot of things that you were, a lot of freedom that you had in your own way, because anything went. Even though you were prisoners.
Well, we were out of control of our parents. This is the big thing. I mean, in an ordinary family, the parents have a certain amount of leverage on their kids. They, you know, there are pocket money, there are treats, little, you know, bits of candy or presents. You know, the parents can say, well, what do you want for Christmas? And this helps to maintain their authority over their children. Now, in our camp, there were no treats. There was no candy. There were no Christmas presents. The food ration, such as it was, you know, delivered once a day, and you know the parents did nothing to provide for their children in that sense. Though of course many parents starve themselves to feed their children. I don't want to give the impression that the children were totally on their own. They weren't. But there weren't those levers to pull. So particularly the teenage boys like myself, did run wild and got up to amazing pranks when I look back. I mean, all this climbing through the wire.
That's pretty dangerous stuff, really. I mean, if a guard finds you, it's all over, right?
Well, yes. I mean, I look back on the things I did. And having brought up three children of my own in a very, very quiet and safe English suburb, I'm amazed at the things we used to do. Luckily, I came through.
A few minutes ago, you were talking about the media landscape and how one of the things that amazes you about the 20th century is this just an incredible amount of media, how everything gets turned into media. How did you feel when you knew that Empire of the Sun was going to become a movie, directed by Steven Spielberg? Did that please you, or were you concerned about it?
I was absolutely stunned. I could hardly believe it. I mean, it was like somebody tapping you on the shoulder and saying, you know, you're going to be the president of the United States. And to have, the greatest living filmmaker, Steven Spielberg, make a movie of your novel is, you know, beyond any writer's dream. And particularly, of course, I mean, the curious thing is that in our different ways, Steven Spielberg and myself had a very similar background. I mean, most of his early films were in the science fiction field, and a lot of my early career as a writer was in science fiction. So, I mean, I'd seen his films, and I admired them tremendously, in particular Close Encounters, which is very near to my kind of science fiction, in fact. I already knew how his imagination worked. Mm-hmm. And I had complete confidence in him. And then when I met him, I was very impressed. I mean, he was nothing like the picture that I'd read about. He was a very serious, thoughtful, strong-minded man. He talked to me at some length about how he planned to shoot certain quite difficult scenes in the book. And he never showed any signs of wanting to cut corners or sentimentalize or take the easy way out. I mean, he confronted all the difficult scenes head on. And within about 3 minutes of meeting him, I knew the film was in the best possible hands.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you one more thing about the younger part of your life. When you got out of the prisoner of war camp, in which you explained your parents basically had no control over you and you ran wild with the rest of the kids and the teenagers, when you went back to England and you started going to school in England, was it possible for any of the adults to discipline you after that? Did you have any, you know, respect for authority figures like parents and teachers afterwards?
Not much, no. To be honest, I came to England, you see, for the first time in 1946 at the age of nearly 16 and went to a British boarding school, which was rather like a camp, rather like a prison camp in many ways. I mean, rather like the camp I'd been in, only, you know, to be honest, the food was even worse. And I found it weird and very, very strange. I found England very strange. I wasn't prepared for it. I'd come from a very hot landscape of rice paddies and, you know, monsoons and summer floods. And I arrived at this dark grey northern country, the light, I mean, it seemed to be sort of, it always seemed to be early evening, and it always seemed to be raining, and everybody seemed, I mean, England was exhausted by the war. The country was, you know, physically half destroyed by the German bombing, and I felt a stranger there, and still do in many respects. It was a very dark, closed, sort of, you know, repressed kind of world. And going to school there and then to university was all very mysterious. It took a long, I couldn't, you know, the English class system was so complicated, I couldn't understand it. Still don't in many ways. So it was a difficult time, but I mean, I wasn't unhappy, but it was like sort of, you know, somebody from, say, you know, a young American going to live in, you know, Japan, let's say, in the 1930s. You know, you're an outsider. There's no hope of understanding the complicated social relationships and all the little rituals and all the rest of it. It takes years to...
But you stayed. It's not like you moved someplace else.
Well, you see, in 1949, my father stayed on in Shanghai after the war. But in 1949, the communists took over the whole of China. And in fact, my father was caught by the communists in Shanghai. And he was there for about a year until he was finally able to get out. And I knew by 1949 that I would never go back to China, that I had to make my home in England. Mm-hmm. Then I got married and had children. And I always dreamed of going abroad. Still do. But, you know, inertia takes over. And I am English. I mean, I can't pretend that I'm not.
Right. Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer J.G. Ballard, and his books include Empire of the Sun, a semi-autobiographical novel that Steven Spielberg made into a movie very recently. His new novel is titled The Day of Creation. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer J.G. Ballard is my guest. There's a book of yours that I really must ask you about. This is a novel that you wrote, I think it was 1973, called Crash. And the book kind of was about someone who was almost erotically obsessed with car crashes and with the wounds inflicted by car crashes. And this character has fantasies of blood and mucus and sperm mingling on the dashboard of a car after a crash. It's a very upsetting book. I would love to know what was on your mind when you wrote this.
Something pretty nasty, I think, if I look back. But it was a serious novel. I mean, it wasn't just a sensational horror story. I mean, I was very conscious in the 70s of the way in which the, you know, what I call the media landscape of particularly, you know, TV and mass advertising was beginning to, you know, create the world that we inhabited, and it seemed to me that the sort of this TV landscape we all live in, or the media landscape we all live in, is hungry for sensation. And we saw then the way in which violence was beginning to be take the sort of place that sex had occupied up until, say, the 60s. Then attitudes towards sex liberalized, and people needed a new thrill. And one began to see, I mean, movies got a lot more violent. Television itself began to show endless scenes of, you know, Civil War newsreels from the Congo and Bangladesh, and then, of course, Vietnam. Very, very graphic scenes of violence were shown, but neutralized by the TV screen. I mean, people saw incredible horrors on their living room screens while they were eating their suppers. But they weren't touched by the violence. And it seemed to me that I wanted to look at the way that sort of violence was beginning to enter into people's imaginations. And Crash took an extreme example of this. Because car crashes, of course, in movies and so on, play a key role. So I try to be honest about it and let my own imagination rip.
Well, I think I read that after you wrote Crash, that you were in a car crash yourself, and in fact one in which your car rolled over a couple of times. Is that right?
Yeah, that was a sort of extreme case of nature imitating art.
Well, did your book about this person who had eroticized car crashes affect the way you experienced your car crash at all? I'm not saying that you got into it or anything, but I mean, you must have thought about what it meant that you'd written this book. You'd spent all this time seeing things through the eyes of the character, and then you were in this terrible car crash yourself.
Yes, and I often thought that if I died in the car crash, people would have said, "Ah, yes, Ballard was finding, sort of the ultimate sex death that he'd been writing and dreaming about." Actually, by a miracle, I wasn't hurt at all. The car rolled over on a divided carriageway and obliterated a whole lot of street lamps and sign indicators. The roof was crushed down, and I couldn't get out, actually. It was a miracle that it didn't burst into flames. Because people were running around the car, rocking it and shouting, "Well, petrol, petrol, gasoline, gasoline." But some guardian angel kept watch over me that evening. But when one writes a novel, one's working in with metaphors, with the materials of the imagination, and crash is a kind of extreme metaphor to deal with an extreme possibility.
But we have this concept of sin, that some things are even sinful to think about, and you'll get punished even for the thought, right? And I bet that went through some people's minds, and perhaps even yours?
Yes, it did. I mean, I spent about 2.5 years writing Crash, and it was like a calculated psychopathic act made... I mean, it was a great moral challenge to me, and made all the more pointed by the fact that I was bringing up, I'm a widower, and I was bringing up my three children myself, and they were, young children crossing the road every day. I couldn't help but think that, life could have played a very cruel trick on me, or taught me a very cruel lesson, and still could, of course. But when in the realm of the imagination, one must be honest. I mean, it would have been very easy to have written a conventional little morality tale proving that, violence is bad for you and one should do a good turn every day. But I was going back to what I was saying about the way in which violence and sensation is the sort of lifeblood of the mass media. I felt I had to be true to the particular idea that I'd got by the tale.
My guest is writer J.G. Ballard, and his best-known recent book is Empire of the Sun, upon which the Steven Spielberg movie was based. His new novel is titled The Day of Creation, and I'd like to talk with you about this new novel. The novel is set in Central Africa. It's about a doctor who works for a World Health Organization clinic, and he really wants to discover a river, because this area really needs water. And a river does form, but then he becomes as obsessed with stopping the river as he had been with creating a river. Do you see this as a parable?
Yes, I think it's a parable of the way people do behave in life. People do get jealous of their own creations. They get jealous of the success of their children, sadly, and the success of their wives and husbands. People are very ambiguous about, their own creations. I mean, we've all known people who've started successful businesses, say, and then when it comes time to retire, you see them sort of half-consciously trying to make certain that the business fails when they're gone. People are very ambiguous about success and about about things they've created, even if it's just a small garden or a little business, or even a major company. And my book is in a sense a fable about the way in which we can become obsessed with the things we've created, develop delusions of grandeur about them, and then, all those kind of ambiguities that are wrapped up inside us come out.
Well, I want to get back also to your interest in how the media has taken over. There's a television documentary maker who's following this doctor around. And one of the characters comments in the book, sooner or later, everything gets turned into television. You don't like TV documentaries very much, do you?
Well, I'm thinking, of course, primarily of the sort of wildlife documentaries you see on British TV, because that's what I watch most of the time. So I can't speak for American TV. But
we see a lot of those, by the way. They're exported.
Yeah, I've got a terrible feeling they are. And they're helping to sort of rot the moral fabric of the rest of the world, because what they present is a sort of sentimentalized view of nature. They want nature, you know, they represent nature as a sort of bushy-tailed mammal that lies down on your hearth rug and puts its paws in the air. Nature isn't like that. Nature is extremely cruel. You know, Homo sapiens has won his intelligence from an extremely hostile environment. And these wildlife documentaries, and it's not just those, it's all these science documentaries, and I would say in many respects, the TV medium itself presents the sentimentalized and romanticized view of reality with all the sharp edges rounded off, satisfying kind of, you know, our sort of most, you know, romantic notions of what life is about. And in a sense, getting between us and reality. And this is the problem faced by the doctor hero of the Day of Creation. He creates this extraordinary river in the middle of a desert, and then finds that this documentary maker with his TV unit has pounced on him and is beginning to sort of, you know, see it in his own sentimental terms. And I mean, I asked the question in the book, really, sort of, is a sort of simple creative act possible today? Can you do anything without the mass media immediately descending on you and imposing their own kinds of their own fantasies on yours? And you know, my character is constantly trying to escape from this TV man who sort of sits on his shoulders, as it were, you know, like Sinbad with the Old Man of the Sea.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work and your ideas and your life. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
J.G. Ballard has been my guest, and he's a writer who started off writing science fiction. His recent books include Empire of the Sun, which is a semi-autobiographical story of his coming of age in a prisoner of war camp in Shanghai, a Japanese prisoner of war camp. Steven Spielberg made that into a movie. Ballard's new novel, The Day of Creation, has just been published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with violinist Isaac Stern. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a new voice to sing some old favorites and to introduce us to some forgotten songs. We meet Wesla Whitfield, a San Francisco singer with a growing reputation. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy. Kevin says they specialize in subversive revivals of well-worn tunes. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the CBS remake of The Caine Mutiny. It stars Brad Davis as the paranoid Commander Queeg, and it's directed by Robert Altman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Wampenschmidt. Labor unrest in Poland is growing, with strikes spreading today to the Lenin shipyard. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has the latest from Warsaw.
The Polish government is playing down this latest occupation of the Lenin shipyard. A government spokesman said the attempt by a few hundred people to touch off a strike there failed and had little impact. But a spokesman for the outlawed Solidarity Trade Union said 2,000 to 3,000 workers began the strike in Gdansk today, and that they have the support of the 12,000 workers at the shipyard. They're demanding pay raises up to $50 a month more, as well as reinstatement of fired union activists, recognition for the local chapter of Solidarity, and amnesty for all strikers. In August 1980, it was a strike over reinstating a union activist at the Gdansk shipyard that led to a mass movement called Solidarity, which had as many as 10 million members before it was banned in a martial law crackdown in late 1981. This past week has seen the most serious strikes in Poland since then, which many observers here believe could produce a new confrontation between the government and workers, but in a less hopeful mood than 8 years ago. I'm Bill Buesenberg in Warsaw.
Today in Lynchburg, Virginia, Oliver North made his first public speaking appearance since the Iran-Contra hearings. He was the commencement speaker at the Reverend Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. Details from NPR's Mara Liasson.
Just one day after Oliver North retired from the Marine Corps, he began to speak out publicly. He chose Liberty University to make his first appearance. The student body here is conservative and Christian and almost uniformly enthusiastic about Oliver North. North described himself as having been vilified and hounded by congressional committees and the special prosecutor. He repeated his claim that he was caught in the middle of a foreign policy debate between the Congress and the president. And as North went on to speak about family values and the threat of communism, he was interrupted by applause several times. He got a standing ovation when he told the students that he considered the crimes he'd been accused of to be a badge of honor. North received no money for his speech today. Liberty University spokesmen say they never have paid a commencement speaker, and it is not known if North plans to schedule any more speaking engagements while he is on trial for his role in the Iran-Contra affair. In Lynchburg, I'm Mara Liasson.
The United Methodist Governing Conference today decided to retain its rules forbidding ordination of admitted homosexuals. Opponents have criticized the rule, calling it unfair and unenforceable. Methodists have struggled for 18 years with the status of homosexuals in the nation's second-largest Protestant denomination. President Reagan today renewed his promise to veto the omnibus trade bill passed by Congress last week. In a speech to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the president said a provision in the bill requiring notification of plant closings is no friend to American workers. He also repeated his plea for Congress to grant the president authority to veto parts of the budget he doesn't like.
Congress has had control of the budget process for 14 years and made a mess of it. 1,000-page continuing resolutions you can hardly lift. Forget about vetoing by the line. I'm ready to veto by the pound.
The president also told the business leaders that he would like to see cuts in the capital gains tax. Orders to U.S. factories rose a surprising 1.6% in March, as strong export demand and heavy defense orders reversed weakness in the previous 2 months. The Commerce Department also reports today that construction spending rose 1.5% in March, the biggest monthly increase in nearly a year. Meanwhile, the Labor Department reports that productivity rose at an annual rate of 0.9% in the first quarter of the year, after falling by 1% in the last quarter of 1987. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 11 points to finish at 2043.27. Declines outpaced advances 7-4. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says trumpeter Lester Bowie is a musical comedian as well as a virtuoso improviser, and that's evident on recordings with his band Brass Fantasy. Bowie was a key player in Chicago's jazz avant-garde in the 60s, and for over 20 years he's played with the Art Ensemble of Chicago. But as for Brass Fantasy's latest recording, Kevin has mixed feelings.
These days, musicians are digging deep into jazz's rich history, and as a result, brass bands have been making a comeback. Young New Orleans units like the Dirty Dozen and the Rebirth Jazz Band honor their city's old parade bands, in which many early jazzmen worked. In modern jazz, the closest thing to a drum and bugle corps is Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy, a 9-piece group with 4 trumpets, 2 trombones, French horn, tuba, and drums. Their third album is Twilight Dreams on the Venture label. Lester Bowie has always been something of a creative historian, specializing in the subversive revival of well-worn tunes like Hello Dolly and Let the Good Times Roll. Where Sonny Rollins imbues unlikely songs with dignity, making them seem brand new, Bowie's ironic readings make knowing reference to the original recordings. Typically, he'll mock a tune out. His command of half-valve techniques gives him the most speech-like and sarcastic sound in jazz. Brass Fantasy's remake of the 1959 hit Personality is faithful enough to make you remember how good the Lloyd Price version was. And yet Bowie still manages to sound a little snide. High points like Personality aside, Brass Fantasy's new album is disappointing. Often, the group sounds less like a reborn early jazz ensemble than like a hungover college football band. Nowadays, lowly marching bands are becoming respectable, judging from Spike Lee's movie School Days, and from the sound of Henry Threadgill's septet and Ed Wilkerson's octet Eight Bold Souls. But Bowie, like Lee and Threadgill, adopts marching bands' weaknesses along with their strengths. Steve Turry is a fine trombonist, but his arrangement of Michael Jackson's Thriller sounds like it was written and rehearsed in 6 minutes flat. Bowie rises above that pedestrian arrangement. But that only emphasizes the disparity between some of these ensemble charts and the strong showings by players like Bowie, trumpeter Stanton Davis, and tuba whiz Bob Stewart. And bad as Thriller gets, with a tacky special effects finish, it's not the worst thing on the album. That honor goes to a disco track with mechanical hand claps, particularly obnoxious with a drummer as good as Philip Wilson aboard. More than Brass Fantasy's other albums, Twilight Dreams is a group effort, with trombonists Turi and Frank Lacey writing most of the music. Steve Turi's Duke's Fantasy is easily the best of the four new tunes. It's a deft homage to Ellingtonian brass textures, including the jungle growls that inspire Bowie. But when it comes to Poop Like Thriller, the leader knows best. This album doesn't have quite enough of his garlicky personality. When Brass Fantasy plays Popcorn, I wish Bowie would opt for benign despotism instead of democratic rule.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Lester Bowie's new recording with Brass Fantasy called Twilight Dreams on the Venture label. This is Fresh Air. For people who love pop standards, songs by Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen, Frank Lesser, it's hard to find new interpreters. Singer Wesla Whitfield is gaining a reputation for her cabaret performances. Early in her career, she sang in the chorus of the San Francisco Opera. Now she performs with her husband, Mike Greensill, accompanying her at the piano. They've just completed a new record, so we invited Wesla Whitfield to join us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco, the city where she lives. Here's a sample of the new record.
Ask me how do I feel, ask me now that we're cozy and clinging. Well, sir, all I can say is if I were a bell, I'd be ringing. From the moment we kissed tonight, that's the way I've just got to behave. Boy, if I were a lamp, I'd light, or if I were a banner, I'd wave. Ask me how do I feel, little me, with my quiet upbringing. Well, sir, all I can say is if I were a gate, I'd be swinging. And if I were a watch, I'd start popping my spring. Or if I were a bell, I'd go ding dong, ding dong, ding.
I always love to hear how singers started loving the songs that they ended up singing. When did you start to like these kinds of songs?
When I was about 4, and I got into my mother's piano bench and found all of her old sheet music and started playing them on the piano.
This is when you were 4?
Well, I started hearing them when I was 4. I started playing them when I was 7.
Oh.
Not a child prodigy, don't worry. And they were such beautiful songs, especially the lyrics were so wonderful. Sentiments that I felt were something I could relate to. And that's what I like best about them.
Are there songs that you feel you can't touch because they're owned by another singer?
Absolutely. Certainly Over the Rainbow is one of those tunes that you can only do in very limited places because it is Judy Garland's song.
Are there songs that you feel are really yours? That are especially yours?
No. Maybe in 40 years, but certainly not now. I think that would be...
I think, you know, it's interesting when you're putting together a set for either a record or for a performance. It's very exciting to sing new songs, songs that you've just learned or songs that are fairly obscure. But I have a feeling that audiences especially like to hear things that are familiar, where they know the lyrics and can sing along in their minds.
You have to strike that balance to an extent. I am lucky in that my audience is very willing to hear new old songs. They're willing to hear most any song if it's good. There are a lot of obscure songs that are obscure for a reason.
Which is the song on your new record that you think of as the most interesting find or the most obscure song?
Well, I don't know if it's the most obscure, but the most interesting song for me on this new album is A Kiss to Build a Dream On. To me, it's the most beautiful song. It's compelling. It was written in 1936 and then brought to life again in 1951. And until I found it in a secondhand music box at a store for 10 cents, I hadn't heard it for years. And so we recorded it, and then a few months later I was in Los Angeles and heard someone else singing it brightly and happily. That to me is the most favorite.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on.
You know, something I've noticed about your singing style, you really don't scat. You really sing, stick pretty closely to the melody, and I actually really like that. And I wonder why you stick to the melody and don't scat.
Because, again, it's for me, it's all lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
Singers have that one thing that instrumentalists don't have. They have the words. They get to add that. And for me, that's why I'm doing it. That's one of my big weapons for getting my idea over. Some people scat wonderfully. A lot of people scat badly. I don't want to ever scat badly. And that's the other reason for not scatting.
Well, I think some singers, too, feel that to sing jazz, that it's essential to scat. Otherwise, they're not really a jazz singer.
I don't know what the definition of jazz singer is, and that is a bone of contention from time to time. What is a jazz singer? I'm sure everyone has their opinion of that, but you don't have to scat to sing jazz. Certainly Rosemary Clooney is a jazz singer, and she does not scat.
Do you think of yourself as a jazz singer?
I don't know. Ask me in 40 years.
Okay. If not jazz, then what? Pop?
It's a real problem. I have been labeled many things, and I think they all fit, or they don't fit at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think of myself as a singer of the great American popular song.
With all the words at my command, I still can't make you understand. I'll always love you, come what may. My heart is yours, what more can I say? I'd steal life for you. I'd tell the stars from the skies for you. If that ain't love, it will have to do until the real thing comes along.
Your career and your life really changed over 10 years ago. You were shot in the back and paralyzed from the waist down. Would you mind if I asked you a little bit about that?
Okay.
What happened?
I was shot. As you said, I was shot, and I became paralyzed, and am.
You were walking down the street, or what was the incident?
Oh, I was just walking from a friend's house back to my car, and there were a couple little kids, and they had a gun. And I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Did it take a while before you started singing again after you were shot?
Well, yes, because, as you might expect, I was quite depressed for a few years, and I didn't start singing again. Well, I sang immediately afterwards for about 3 months, but it was quite boring because I really wasn't there mentally or emotionally, and you must be there. And so I stopped singing and just became totally depressed for about 3 years, went to therapy, got my head back together, and started singing again.
If you don't mind my asking, you know, there's so much emotional depth that goes into singing.
Yeah.
And the more you've lived and the more you've experienced in a lot of ways, the more capable you are of interpreting a song with depth. Did the terrible thing that you went through when you were shot, when you emerged on the other end from a period of years of not singing, did you feel that there was like any kind of breakthrough or anything in your own singing of reaching like a new level of understanding or of depth? Sometimes I think that's how we rationalize terrible things. And if I would say, well, but I'll understand a lot more afterwards.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know how much of that was because I was shot or how much of it was because
you didn't sing.
Years went by.
Yeah.
Just years went by. And so I don't know. I've never tried to rationalize having been shot. It seems pointless. It rarely occurs to me anymore. It doesn't define me. I'm not Mrs. Physically Disabled. I'm me, and it rarely occurs to me that I'm disabled. That sounds so Pollyanna, but it's just true. It's not on my mind much.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had resistance from club owners singing because you'd be singing from a wheelchair?
I don't sing from the wheelchair.
Oh, you don't
sing clubs.
From a wheelchair? Uh-huh.
I put myself in, it's a like a bar stool.
Oh.
Because to sing in the chair is very distracting.
Uh-huh.
And then nobody hears the song. So I just sit in another chair, and then we can just go on from there.
Twice during this interview, you've said, ask me in 40 years. What do you think is going to be different in 40 years?
I don't know. Ask me in 40 years.
All right.
Having just turned 40, I am realizing that in the last 20 years, so much has happened to me, and my thought processes have expanded to such an amazing degree. I can only hope that it'll happen in the next 40 as well.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Wesla Woodfield's new album is called Until the Real Thing Comes Along. She'll be performing at the Plush Room in San Francisco from May 24th through June 5th.
Until the real thing comes along.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, our top story is that the strikes in Poland have spread and the demands have escalated. Now, workers at the Lenin shipyard in Gdańsk have gone out on strike. That is, of course, where the outlawed Solidarity Union was born. It's Lech Wałęsa's home base. And they're not just asking for pay raises. They're demanding the re-legalization of Solidarity, something that the government, I think one can safely predict, will fight them on. Also tonight, at last, music please. Yes, All Things Gone with the Wind tonight.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This weekend, CBS is airing a remake of The Caine Mutiny. You may remember Humphrey Bogart on the witness stand nervously rolling a handful of steel balls in the 1953 movie version of the story. The CBS remake was directed by Robert Altman. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
It was the principle of respect for command. That principle was dead when I came aboard that ship, but I brought it to life And I nagged, and I crabbed, and I bitched, and I hollered, but by God, I made it stick while I was the captain.
9 times out of 10, a TV remake of a classic movie, or a classic play, is a classic waste. Even that 10th time out of 10, the most you can hope for is a draw, with one or two performances good enough to make the comparison interesting. This Sunday, CBS is presenting a remake of The Caine Mutiny, the Herman Woke story that was both a classic movie and a classic play. The image of Humphrey Bogart as Lieutenant Commander Queeg rattling those silver balls and ranting about strawberries is as fresh now as it was when the movie was made, and that was almost 35 years ago. Yet this new version of the Caine Mutiny court-martial is better than the movie and one of the better things on TV this year. The cast is impressive. It has to be because this new version is all talk and no action, except for one final scene outside the courtroom. Otherwise, there are no flashbacks, no breaks in the testimony, just questions and answers, delivered believably and matter-of-factly by a great bunch of young actors. Brad Davis has the Bogart role of Commander Queeg, and Jeff Daniels plays Stephen Merrick, the lieutenant on trial for mutiny. Michael Murphy plays the captain in charge of the trial, and the attorneys are played by Peter Gallagher, who portrayed the accused killer in The Murder of Mary Fagan, and writer-performer Eric Bogosian. Everybody's wonderful, But the most wonderful contribution of all comes from the director, Robert Altman. What Altman has done here, quite obviously, is pattern this trial after such recent TV proceedings as the Iran-Contra hearings. While witnesses are testifying, attorneys and court officers slip in and out or look bored or whisper to each other. Witnesses speak naturally and nervously, and sometimes are distracted by the sights and sounds from outside the court, which in this case is literally a court, a basketball court on a naval base, with bands practicing outside and words echoing inside. Altman films all of this with a very nervous camera, one that is liable to wander away from a witness and catch an offhand glance from a background character. Even when it keeps one character in the frame is slowly shifting from side to side or in and out to keep things moving, or to keep them looking less staged. Altman began his career in television, directing everything from Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Combat to The Millionaire, and it's kind of neat that he's revived his career after a string of film flops by returning to TV. He's done two Pinner plays for ABC and a bunch of plays for cable TV, including The Laundromat for HBO. And beginning this week on HBO is the latest installment of Tanner 88, a political satire written by Gary Trudeau and directed by Altman. Tanner 88 is good, the Kane Mutiny court-martial is great, and Robert Altman is back.
What do I care for strawberries? It was a question of principle. Pilfering is pilfering, and on my ship... Oh, not that we had so many treats either, with those slow-motion mess treasures of ours. Not like when I was an ensign, believe me, they made me jump, sure enough. And we need to get something pleasant like strawberries once in a blue moon. Why, it was an outrage not to have another helping if I felt like it. And I wasn't going to let them get away with that, and I didn't. By God, there was no more of that again on that ship.
That was Brad Davis as the desperate Captain Queeg. David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with Saturday Night Live alumnus Denitra Vance. You might remember her TV sitcom send up That Black Girl or her performances of Shakespeare in the Slums. She co-stars in the new movie Sticky Fingers. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile one of the funniest rock groups from the other side of the Atlantic, the Bonzo Dog Band. And book critic John Leonard will review Quinn's book, the new novel by William Kennedy. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.